This week on Family Anatomy, Anatomy of Three Things.
The hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologists. So if you want to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spazzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. And we are talking about three recent research papers, three recent studies from the world of psychology. And in fact, I brought two tonight that are hot off the presses that are March 2010.
And I have an ancient 2009 study that we can talk about.
That's old news. Why are we even going to talk about that?
So old.
Ridiculous. I can't believe you're so lazy.
I know.
You don't even look at the new journals.
I got to dig around for the 2011 studies to be really...
See?
Eh?
You're taking my leftovers. The studies that I throw away, oh, that's old news. Those are the ones.
Why
that you
stop
want to
there?
Talk about.
2020 studies I'm bringing next time.
All right, let's do that.
I'm telling you.
Let's do that. So, the first one that we're going to talk about tonight is one that I brought that talks about how sleep problems and drug use can spread through the high school community among friends.
Right. And then I have another study that's going to be looking at dental health and how that might be related to eating disorders in young people.
And the third one is one that made me think, why aren't I doing more psychology research? And it's an Australian study about how skateboarders change their behavior based on whether there's a pretty girl watching them. And you're dropping papers on the floor.
Dropping papers.
Hey, let's get right into the first story. So this is one from an online journal called plos1.org. And this is a great journal because it's peer-reviewed, but people have access to the entire paper, so you don't have to pay anything to get it. So it's just anybody can go ahead and read this information, which is great. So Mednick and colleagues looked at 90,000 students between grade 7 and grade 12, and they surveyed all of these people, and then they had them name five male friends and five female friends and looked at those people as well. And they continued to collect information from 1994 all the way up to 2002. And what they wanted to find out about was whether sleep difficulties would be passed on from one person to another, so that whole groups are having trouble getting to sleep. And they looked at the same kind of thing for drug use. And what they wound up doing was they divided everyone into kind of two groups as far as sleep goes. They looked at people who were sleeping for more than 7 hours and people who were getting 7 hours or less. And I think the recommended, for this age group, I think they talked about the recommended amount of sleep being around 8.5 hours or so, you know, because they're growing and all of that stuff.
That's right.
Right. So what they found was that both of these behaviors, whether it's drug use or sleep problems, that these things spread up to 4 degrees of separation.
Wow.
That your behavior can affect the behavior of your friends. So it really does go through the whole network, right? They found that if somebody's sleeping less than 7 hours, that for every friend you have who sleeps less than 7 hours, you're 5% more likely to also sleep less than 7 hours. So it really, it gradually increases the likelihood that you're going to be one of those people who's not getting enough sleep. Now, the issue here is that if you're not sleeping enough, sleep problems are linked to all kinds of behavior regulation problems and difficulties concentrating and not necessarily, well, maybe acting without thinking about consequences and things like that, right?
So, you know, the typical thing that they've found in previous studies was that if you're taking drugs, it's going to negatively affect your sleep. But what they found in this study was that the opposite is also true.
Yeah, yeah.
Having sleeping problems increases your likelihood to do drugs as well. Sleeping problems are related to a lot of things. I mean, it increases the likelihood of panic attacks and anxiety disorders as well. But here, the other thing they found is that if you have a friend that uses marijuana, increases the likelihood of you using marijuana by 110%.
It's doubling the likelihood that you're going to be a user, which to me is incredible. Now, they found, though, that the opposite was also true. For every friend that you have who's not using marijuana, you're 10% less likely to use.
Which is probably the more important thing to keep in mind there, because it gives you a sense of how you might want to intervene in this.
Well, that's a really positive finding, right? So if it almost points to sort of a whole community intervention where you're trying to really reduce drug use so that lots of people will have some friends who aren't using, and that'll make them less likely to use, and so on and so on.
Well, yeah, it gives you a sense of how big the impact how big an impact you could have. Like, let's say that you have a sense that your son or daughter is having a drug problem, for instance, or a sleeping problem for that matter. If they get help for that, they're not only helping themselves, they're helping their network of friends. And I guess it comes back around too. The more their network of friends is affected in a positive way, the more that comes back to them as well.
And that's some really good news, I think, that comes out of the study, is that if you can intervene, right, we talked about whole community interventions to reduce drug use, but if you can do some sleep interventions and get people sleeping better and getting the right amount of sleep, particularly if you pick a few really central people who are connected to a large number of others, you know, people who are in the center of the social network, well, that can have ripple effects out to 4 degrees of separation, like we said, and wind up having an impact not just on sleep but on drug use. And if all these people are getting a good sleep, then they're going to be doing better at school. There might be lower levels of anxiety. There might be all kinds of other behaviors that are improved as well.
There's lots of benefits. You know, this study reminds me of one that we talked about some while back. There seems to be this area of research that looks at kind of a contagion effect. Mm-hmm. And we had this, remember, we were talking about loneliness and how that extends out several degrees as well.
Yeah, we talked about how happiness also goes out several degrees of separation too. So I find these studies really interesting. You get these beautiful diagrams of whole social networks and how things change over time. And I think part of the reason why we're seeing this now is that, well, number one, there are a number of big data sets that people can analyze in this way. And now we have the computer horsepower to really plug in and look for those kinds of relationships.
That's right. So we have the ability to look at it in a way we didn't before. And I think that there's a general philosophical thing that's happening too, that we're in sort of a global community, and the idea of interrelatedness is a very big one as well. And that's basically what they're studying.
Well, here we are, two people who do family therapy, who look at the impact that one person's problems can have on the entire system. Well, this is just the bigger system, right? And this is the first one that I've seen lately that looks at adolescent social networks, so high school students. And I just found that to be fascinating, because the social world is so important at that age level.
You're right. Now, I think it's a very interesting study. On the other hand, it's something that I knew before, because, for instance, when you fall asleep during the podcast, it makes it much more likely that I'll fall asleep.
Exactly. And if our listeners fall asleep, then
it's time to go on to the next story.
Exactly. Let's get on to your dental hygiene story.
Dental hygiene story. Now,
I came from the dentist this afternoon.
Last week.
Okay.
But I don't know why. I feel like every time I get a research story, I always pick researchers whose names are so difficult for me to say.
Yes.
And you've kind of helped me on this one. The lead researcher here is Rosanna.
What do you think?
Jimenez.
But it's an X, but I just Jimenez. Think it looks like a Jimenez to me.
Right. Gerald Kotu and Everton Suge.
One day we will learn how to read.
Yes, we will. There are three PhDs. And
And this is from what journal? This 2009 in the Dental...
International Journal of Eating Disorders.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. So it's not a dentist journal.
It's not a dentist journal. But so what they looked at, because, the you know, I guess some important things to know before we get into it is eating disorders are typically triggered in the teen years. And there's a high prevalence, the highest prevalence actually, it peaks around 14 to 17 years of age, eating disorders. So I guess...
This has been a huge problem. I mean, there's quite a large number of people who are affected by, and not just the patients themselves, their whole family unit. We talk about networks, right? The whole family unit, the whole communities can be affected by eating disorders. It's incredible how, it's sad, really, how much the impact of that spreads too.
It is for sure. And so what they were looking at is that, how is it, is there any early indicators? And I guess there could be a lot of different ones, but the ones that they tried to focus on here were, was there some evidence in the teeth, in the mouths of people who would later be found out to have an eating disorder?
So, well, that's one of the dangers that they talk about with the purging kind of disorders, is that the acid in it, that comes through your esophagus and through your mouth
when you're vomiting
is going to have an effect on your mouth and your teeth and your esophagus, and it's certainly an indicator later on that there may be a problem, right? It's one of the long-term risk factors of those disorders.
That's right. And so they looked at 250 teens between the ages of 12 and 16 years of age. And what they found is that they were able to connect lesions, gum disease, erosion in the teeth to eating disorders. So that what they said was that it helps early detection of subclinical cases of eating disorders. So it's kind of an early sign, and doesn't mean they will definitely have an eating disorder. They're subclinical cases.
So that means they have fewer symptoms, or maybe they might be experimenting, for example, and maybe it's not as chronic as a real clinical eating disorder would be.
But it helps you pick them up before they get to that stage.
Yeah, early intervention, right? I'm sure we've talked about it on the show before, and certainly it comes out over and over again in the research. The earlier you can intervene with a particular disorder or some kind of a problem, the better off you're going to be.
It's funny the kinds of indicators that you can get. I mean, who would think that you'd go to Dennis to get some early signs of that? But this is a really important piece of information. Kids go to dentists. Parents can have access to that kind of information. Right.
And we're talking about 13-year-olds, and yeah, they do. What's the recommended number of dental visits? I think you go every 6 months or every 9 months
right.
or so. And so that's a regular checkup. These results are things that dentists need to be aware of, right?
That's right. That's right. Dentists and parents. I mean, parents can make their dentists aware of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like archaeology here, in a way. You know, it feels like, have you ever been to the dentist and, you know, they're looking into your mouth, you don't get to see it, but there's one time the dentist held up a mirror and it really felt like it was like archaeology in there.
It's like a cave
mirror and it's magnified. Anyways, the idea that it's like an archaeological expedition is, I heard this recent news story where they were saying, you know, there's the recession in the United States and all of the different effects. There's the obvious ones. People mm-hmm. lose their jobs and they're losing their homes and there's higher bankruptcies and all the rest. Well, another unexpected effect of the recession has been a really high spike in the number of broken, chipped, and eroding teeth.
Yeah, I believe that. Those are expensive visits.
Well, it's the stress that gets sort of channeled into your jaw muscles, and you get grinding at night, and you get broken teeth from that. So,
well, and there are fewer dental checkups, right? So they're not necessarily
fewer checkups.
They're
sure.
not doing that every 6 months
That's
or every
too.
9 month visit, and so things that maybe start out small that could easily be fixed become bigger and bigger problems when you're not going to the dentist.
That's right. Now, the thing that they were saying specifically was the stress, though, that You know, you go to bed at night, and a lot of people have to get night guards for that,
yeah,
right? Because the stress goes into your jaw, and you end up grinding
your teeth.
You're ruining your teeth. So psychologists need to talk to dentists more.
I think so. Let's write a letter away to the Dental Association.
Yes.
Let's get on to the third story. Now, this was it's sort of an unusual one. It didn't really have any real bearing, I didn't think, necessarily on the kinds of things we usually talk about on the show, but it was, I saw the title and I read a little summary of what it was all about, and I thought, wow, these guys are watching skateboarders. I mean, this is what they're doing for their research. That's pretty incredible. So this is by Rane and von Hippel and in a recent issue of Social, Psychological, and Personality Science, a study called The Presence of an Attractive Woman Elevates Testosterone and Physical Risk-Taking in Young Men. So this is another one of those studies that sort of maybe confirms what you already know. Possibly. They talked in the introduction to the study about some previous research, and I really like this quote. Are you ready for this?
Sure.
I don't know if you noticed this when you went through the article, but here's the quote from previous research. Attractive women have the power to shift men's time perspective away from the long-term consequences of their choices and focus their attention on the here and now. So you wind up you don't think about the long-term impact of the things that you're doing. You're thinking about right now. They talked a little bit about how there's some evolutionary drive towards that kind of behavior, because if you take risks, you might be more likely to get the bigger payoff in terms of passing on your traits to the next generation. And so they used these skateboard tricks as kind of an allegory for other kinds of risk-taking that young men get into, whether it's behind the wheel of a car or getting into a confrontation with another guy at a bar, fighting over a girl or whatever, because they figured that these skateboard tricks are demonstrations of skill. They require you some bravado. There's some bragging that goes along with it. There's a risk of physical injury. There's a risk of embarrassment associated with them. And you sort of have to make a split-second decision. You might be in the air on a skateboard and have to decide, okay, am I going to do that trick that I'm learning, or am I going to give it a miss, just land it this time, and then go back and try again, because you're worried that you might mess it up, right? So they looked at 96 skateboarders. And that's another thing about the study, right?
I mean, this is a small number, sure.
It's A, a small number, and B, it's kind of a self-selected group, right?
Skateboarders.
You go into a skate park, and it's not like they're putting accountants on skateboards to see if they'll increase their risk-taking. But they looked at skateboarders only, and so they had a male experimenter. These are all male skateboarders, too. They had a male experimenter who would ask them
If you surveyed all the accountants over at Goldman Sachs, might be the same kind of thing. But anyway,
maybe.
I digress.
It's not physical risk-taking necessarily, unless an investor comes back to have a little talk with you. But anyway.
Credit default swaps.
Exactly. So they had a male experimenter with a video camera, and participants in the study were asked to do a trick 10 times that they were just learning. So a trick that they would probably be successful at 50% of the time. So they would repeat that trick 10 times, and they would be videotaped, and they were counting how many times did they fail in their attempt, how many times did they succeed, or how many times did they abort the trick. They call them aborted tricks in the study. And then half of those 96 people had the same experimenter come back and say, okay, show me that 10 times again. And the other half had an attractive 18-year-old female experimenter come back and ask them to do the same thing. And then they looked to see if there was going to be a difference between the two groups.
Right. So one group was in front of the attractive female and the other group in front of the male experimenter.
That's right. That's right. And so what did they find? Of course, obviously we've been hinting at it pretty heavily, right? The skateboarders who had a woman watching them were much more likely to take greater risk. They were less likely to abort the tricks. They crashed more often, but they were also successful more often.
So there was more risky behavior, there was more extremes in the end in their performance. They're more likely to crash, more likely to succeed in something risky. Maybe we should have more women on the show.
Well, we do try to interview
to, you know, push the risk level of our performance
the
here.
Physical risk taking. Right? We'll be hitting each other with microphones before the end right. of the episode, right?
That's right. So it is a kind of a self-evident kind of result in a way, but it's also an interesting result because I'm sure that, well, a part of the reason it's interesting is because it's unconscious.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
They didn't do this, but I'm wondering, you know, if they actually surveyed them to say, did you take more risks just because they were an attractive woman? They wouldn't necessarily say yes to that.
Exactly.
You know, they probably think they're in control and they just do what they do.
They just felt better about it. They felt more confident or whatever, right? Right. Well, because it wasn't just the presence of the woman. They also looked at testosterone levels and things like that. And they found even once they took into account different levels of testosterone in these guys, because testosterone in other studies has been linked to risky behaviors too, right? People who are higher on testosterone are more likely to take risks. But they found that it even once you take into account testosterone levels, still having a woman watching you, they were more likely to do the risky things. But higher levels of testosterone too meant even more risk again. So
right.
You put all of those things together and you get people who are, I mean, you see it on TV and in movies all the time, right? The attractive woman at the bar and all the, and guys falling all over themselves to impress.
Right. And I guess, you know, that's the idea that somehow it's like the peacock effect, right? You're trying to really impress a woman with your risk taking
and if
it
you
has an
see
effect on performance.
Giuseppe's peacocking right now. You wouldn't even believe it. He's got the top hat and the fancy cape.
I am, and I think it's because of the wig that you have on.
Yeah. We're both peacocking, right? Yes,
nice exactly. dress, by the way.
I'm taking a risk right now by coming into the studio.
The interesting thing, though, they had more risk-taking behavior. They're more successful. They crash more. It doesn't really tell you whether it's a better learning strategy that results or that you're more successful over the longer term if someone of the opposite sex. I'm assuming a similar kind of effect could happen the other way, but it doesn't tell you that, you know, if an attractive person was your coach, for instance, and you were a figure skater,
mm-hmm.
right? If that's going to make you more successful, because there's other aspects involved too. It just means you take more risk. So
you would think that the fewer times that you abort those tricks, that in this case they're doing the skateboarding tricks, the fewer times you abort those trips, the more
practice you're getting,
the more
doing
practice
those things,
the more opportunities you have to learn from your mistakes too.
Sure, but there's other factors there. So there could be so you succeed more often but you fail more often. You're also mediating that. So if you're the type of person that one failure affects you twice as much as the next person,
mm-hmm.
You could have 10 successes on your risks and 5 failures, but if you don't have the proper sort of mental coaching or mental makeup, you're going to take those 5 failures as devastating and undervalue those 10 successes. So there's another factor there, obviously, at least.
Well, and like we mentioned at the beginning, these are all people who are already interested in skateboarding, and they're doing these physically risky things to begin with, because, I mean, they're doing the tricks, they're learning how to do the tricks anyway. There's likely to be a group of people, maybe who aren't so into doing skateboarding, but maybe they would be so nervous that they'd be more likely to fail if an attractive woman was watching them do something.
That's also true.
Like, it'd be interesting to extend the study, and, you know, researchers need to befriend lots of attractive experimenters in order to try these things out, I think.
So we can follow up their research on another podcast.
Exactly. And I think that brings us to our website of the week. And the website of the week this week is sciencedaily.com.
Sciencedaily.com, it's a really nice interface. It's sort of written in lay language, and it there's lots of different topics here. It's not just psychology topics, it's science in general. But there is a tab that you can go to that looks at mind and brain subjects, more related to psychology. So you've got latest research into ADHD, addictions, Alzheimer's, depression.
Relationships.
Relationships, intelligence, social psychology, schizophrenia, all kinds of psych topics, and the latest research, and again, like I say, in lay terms, so it's easy to understand, very accessible, and a nice-looking site as well.
Yeah, they take these scientific studies, they translate them so that just about anybody can take a look and get something out of it. They also, sometimes they'll interview the original researcher, and you'll get some information from the people who did the actual study, which I think is a great thing as well.
That's right.
So this site, sciencedaily.com, is one of the ways that both you and I sort of keep up with the latest news in science, and sometimes that's where we find some of the studies that we talk about on the show.
Easy to find. I mean, we have our own sort of psychological database that's more technical in orientation, and it's not really for the lay public, but this is a really good resource for the average person.
It sure is. So sciencedaily.com is our website of the week.
And that's it for the show for this week. You can visit us at familyanatomy.com or email us at info@familyanatomy.com. And as always, Dr. Brian has an announcement.
Well, it's the end of the month. Once again, our Top 3 Things episode always happens at the end of the month. So April is right around the corner, and that means Podcast Alley is resetting their votes. So if you like the show, if you're interested in the things that we do, one of the ways that new listeners come around is if they see that our show is receiving lots of votes at Podcast Alley. So you pop over to podcastalley.com, search Family Anatomy, click on the vote button, and that's just about it. A couple of clicks and you're done. And it helps us out. It spreads the word about the show, which is great. We really appreciate the votes that we've received so far. And that's the end of our show for tonight. So as usual, we'll leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love, who's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening.
It's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do.
FamilyAnatomy.com.